Jimmy Ellis brought authority and passion to a song that came to epitomize the gleeful yet dark excesses of disco, especially when John Travolta boogied to it in the movie Saturday Night Fever. The soundtrack was for a while the best-selling album of all time. Ellis started singing with the group that would become the Tramps in the early 1970s. They called themselves the Tramps with two M's, they joked, because it was classy. The group's fortunes rose and fell over the decades, but James Ellis toured with them as recently as 2 years ago, when he was 72 years old. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
At last glance, we're seeing gains in U.S. stocks with the Dow up 44 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Public Welfare Foundation, supporting coverage of workers' issues. More information at publicwelfare.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Of the next fresh air, the start of the Civil War, and how national leaders and ordinary citizens responded to the chaos and uncertainty. We'll look at how the Civil War continues to reverberate today. We talk with Adam Goodhart, author of the book 1861, which is now out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. I'm sorry, we were planning on this morning talking with another candidate. We're doing a series of candidate conversations in advance of the March primary, and we were going to be talking with Frank Metzger, one of the Republicans seeking his party's spot on the ballot in the 13th Congressional District. He's not with us, and so I'm afraid we're going to have to take a different path here, and we'll go to the archives for a past program on Focus. There have been many people who have argued that the internet and social networking services like Facebook and Twitter can be very powerful tools for political activists working to topple authoritarian regimes. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with someone who makes a very strong counterargument, one that has proven rather controversial. Our guest is Evgeny Morozov, and we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, The Net Delusion. The subtitle is The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. Public Affairs is a publisher of the book. And in this book, he makes the argument that people who talk about Twitter and Facebook and the internet in that way, he says that they're really engaging in a kind of cyber utopian thinking, and that what they're not doing is acknowledging that there is a definite downside of online communication. He makes the argument that, well, indeed, while the internet may well empower people, there are dictators who have learned to use it as well, both for propaganda and for surveillance. So we'll talk in this hour about the net delusion. And, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in, make comments, ask questions. A little bit more about our guest. Evgeny Morozov is a contributing editor to Foreign Policy and Boston Review. He is a Schwartz Fellow at the New American Foundation. He currently is also a visiting scholar at Stanford University. He was previously a Yahoo Fellow at the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University and a Fellow at the Open Society Institute in New York, where he remains on the board of the Information Program, and his writing has appeared in many different publications. He's spoken widely on this issue, done a lot of interviews, and we're pleased that he could be with us this morning. Questions are welcome. And Mr. Morozov, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Good to be here.
I think that as a kind of a case study, and we can begin with the example that you begin with in the book, and to talk about the protests that took place in Iran in 2009 after the presidential election there. I think this was a case where, as things got rolling, the people who were making this argument about, you know, these tools, internet, Facebook, Twitter, as being these powerful liberating tools for people, I think a lot of people said, this is going to be the first real example. This is going to happen, and we're going to see it happen. And as it turned out, of course, it didn't. Let's just talk a little bit about what happened in Iran in 2009.
Sure. Well, I think the Iranian example stands out for several reasons. I mean, first of all, as you've mentioned, I think there was this tendency amongst, you know, many Western observers to think that the protests that they were seeing on the streets of Tehran in the summer of 2009 were all facilitated by social media, and especially by Twitter. And there was actually very little evidence that Twitter was instrumental to organizing the protests, as some people have claimed at the time. It actually turned out that there were relatively few people who were tweeting from Tehran, even though there were a lot of news from Tehran that were reposted on the site. And a lot of people, especially in the West, got extremely, utopian, you know, and enthusiastic about the possibility of political change coming to Iran simply because this revolution seemed to be happening online. So in some sense, I think they overestimated the power of the Internet, while the Internet didn't actually seem to be playing that much of a role in the country. And the second point that I think needs to be emphasized is that this focus on the liberating potential of social media has distracted many analysts from seeing how the same tools were eventually used by the Iranian government after the protests ended. They went online to sites like Facebook and Twitter and collected a lot of information about who was opposing them, who was tweeting, poking messages that were anti-government. They also went to sites like Flickr and YouTube and collected all the photos and videos from the protests in order to learn more about the protesters. They even reposted some of those and republished some of those photos on government-run news sites, asking people for tips about the protesters because they wanted to identify their names. And the government, basically, after the protests quieted down, did benefit a lot from all the information that ended up on social networking sites. So that darker side was overlooked. And I think it's very important for us to remember that if the government, and in this case the Iranian government, doesn't fall in the end, they can very easily exploit the very same tools and platforms that they used to mobilize against them. And this is something that's very important to remember.
Yeah, they used it to get information on who their opponents were. They used that to threaten those people. And they also used it in the same way their opponents did as a way of trying to galvanizing support. So they could use these same kind of networks and tools to get out the message to the people that they thought were their supporters to also get them to rally to the support of the government.
Definitely. And you know, the amount of misinformation on Twitter as the protests continued increased by, you know, I think a factor of 10. I mean, you saw a lot of pro-government messages suddenly popping up on all of the social media sites as, you know, the supporters of the government were also encouraged to go online and engage in disinformation war with others. So, and the government also relied on text messaging, for example, to intimidate people. They sent out a lot of text messages encouraging people to stay at home during the protests. So they made very good use of these tools, if not just to spy on people, but also to intimidate them and create a climate of oppression where people don't want to talk and express what's on their mind, you know, eventually resulting in self-censorship. So these tools offer also a very good platform for the governments if they want to engage in intimidation.
Mm. I think it's interesting because one would imagine, and indeed we have seen examples where what the government did with the Internet essentially was to turn it off so that people could not use it. They couldn't use their cell phones. They couldn't access the Internet to get word out about what they were doing. But this is something different where you can see actually that rather than wanting the government to turn it off, they would think, well, this is something that we can actually turn to our advantage. So we want it, in fact, to be working so that we, the government, can use it.
Well, they did try to slow it down in the case of Iran. So they definitely took some preemptive measures to, you know, limit the capacity of the Internet to mobilize and galvanize protests. They didn't turn it off entirely. Again, I think because they wanted to know more about what was happening on the ground. They did you know, after all, gain and a useful source of intelligence gathering through the social media sites. But also, it's very important to recognize that the governments that turn off the internet during you know, revolutionary upheaval, and you know, you can think of Egypt or Libya here, they're usually the ones which are very ill prepared to the challenges of the internet. They have not spent enough time thinking and designing a sophisticated system of internet controls the way the, you know, the Chinese government or the Russian government have done over the last 10 years. The Egyptian government has not done much at all by way of, you know, internet controls. They did not censor the internet under Mubarak. They did not engage in any sophisticated forms of online surveillance. They did not cultivate their own army of pro-government bloggers. They did very little. So, of course, if they have been disregarding the internet for so long, of course, they paid the price in the end. What I'm arguing is that there are a lot of governments, like the one in Russia, in China, and probably now in Iran, which are far more sophisticated about controlling the internet, and they may not even have to turn the internet off because they will take care of many, you know, brewing protests at an early stage before they spill into the streets. And that's what we see a lot in China, where the government takes preemptive steps to quash all online dissent and protest at the very beginning. Just after, you know, a blog post has been published, or after an anti-government Facebook group has been set up, you know, the Egyptians let their anti-government Facebook group stay on for 6 or 7 months. And of course, if you, you know, allow people to organize and mobilize for that long, you'll eventually pay the price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, would you make the argument, though, that, well, there are, that the governments who have not done this, that is, governments who have not recognized the way that they can use these same tools, they're more and more, they may be looking at governments that have, and that you should expect perhaps some growing number of governments, actually oppressive governments, to realize the potential that these tools have, actually, for them to do the kinds of things, both to get out their own message and also to carry out, use it for intimidation and surveillance of opponents.
Sure. Well, we hear a lot about, you know, activists in Iran and China or Saudi Arabia cooperating with each other and collaborating with each other on, you know, creating anti-censorship tools, for example, or creating tools to protect against cyber attacks. We hear comparatively little about their governments cooperating and learning from each other as well. And I think this is happening, and we'll clearly see more and more governments taking preemptive steps to neutralize and control the internet in the wake of what happened in Egypt and Tunisia and in the wake of what's happening in Libya. Again, even in China, we now see that the government is stepping up its internet control. They will be paying much more attention to the role that American internet companies play in facilitating this uprisals. I mean, we've seen that, for example, this week, Deputy Russian Prime Minister directly blamed Google on facilitating the protests in Egypt simply because one of the executives was involved. So governments learn very quickly, and I do expect them to become much more sophisticated and much more cautious about the power of the internet, and perhaps they will take preemptive steps, and they will be present on sites like Facebook, and they will be trying to control the online conversations that are happening there. In many cases, we already see that happen. In Sudan, for example, President Bashir actually proclaimed that he wants to extend electricity to some of the remotest villages in Sudan so that his supporters can go online, log into Facebook, and battle with his opponents. Again, we don't know the extent to which it was just a propaganda stunt, but we will be seeing more and more efforts like this, where instead of just blocking, governments would want to go and counter their opponents online with propaganda or with cyber attacks or with other tools that go beyond just brutal internet filtering and banning access to particular web pages.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Evgeny Morozov, and we're talking about some of the ideas you will find in his new book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. Public Affairs is the publisher, in which he makes an argument that counters that we have been talking about. That is, a lot of people have said that the internet and tools, social networking tools like Twitter and like Facebook, can be very, very powerful for people who are trying to overthrow oppressive regimes. In fact, he makes a counter-argument that says, well, at least so far, that hasn't been the case. And further, he says that there are some governments that have actually been very good at using these tools also themselves for their own ends, to get out their own messages, to rally their own supporters, to intimidate opponents, to gather information about them. And again, that's all in the book. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think probably there are some people who might want to make the argument that while they might indeed say that you are right, talking about the potential for governments to use these tools themselves and the fact that they have, they might also say at the same time, you have to acknowledge that these tools can continue to be useful for people who are trying to organize. Is that just kind of a wash? Do you think the power of these tools for both sides offset one another? Or would you make the argument that you think actually in this that the governments have the advantage?
Well, I have no problem acknowledging the role that social media can play and has played in events in Egypt or Tunisia, for example. I think it's very important that we credit the internet with facilitating and enabling some of these protests, making them faster, making them probably more visible. All of that is definitely true. I wouldn't go as far as to claim that the protests happened because of the internet, because they happened because of various political and economic and social grievances, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. Revolutions do not happen because of the internet, but the internet can definitely help, particularly if you're looking at weak and already dying authoritarian regimes. Definitely social media can make them die faster. I mean, there is no doubt and argument about that. In the case of Iran, or modern China, or probably modern Russia, we are looking at countries that just are not politically weak and are not economically weak. So the internet's contribution to liberating them is far more limited. If the oil price drops to, $40 per barrel tomorrow, probably the role that the internet can play in Russia will be far more significant, because there will just be much more political and social turmoil. So I have no trouble acknowledging that the internet can be used by activists and various pro-Western and pro-democratic political forces, just like as it can be used by various anti-Western and anti-democratic forces. Again, in Russia, for example, we see a lot of nationalists and extremists who have values that are very far from democratic and which are probably far more totalitarian in their outlook than the Russian government, be very active online. They are far more active in exploring the world and possibilities offered by blogs and social networking sites. And that's something that we need to acknowledge. Otherwise, we wouldn't really understand the full impact that the internet is having in modern Russia. So often, it's not black and white. It's not just the bad guys in the government and the good guys who are opposing them. There are many other forces that you need to consider before you understand the full-blown impact of the internet on many of the societies.
So you're arguing for not that the it sounds like you're arguing, let's put the whole thing in perspective. Let's not overestimate the importance of the internet and social networking. Let's not underestimate, and let's make sure that we look at every country as an individual country and go on a case-by-case basis.
Sure. Again, my primary interest, actually, and the reason why I wrote this book, was to try to get the U.S. governments and the European governments in the European Union policy towards the internet right. I want them to make an internet into a powerful ally in the fight for promoting democracy and human rights and freedom of expression. And the question is, what should be the priority areas? So how should you actually structure institutionally your approach to this problem, in the State Department in Washington, right? And what are the kind of goals and methods that, you should be pursuing? And I think this is a very new issue for many people in Washington. We have seen Hillary Clinton give two speeches on the subject of internet freedom. One was last January in 2010, and one was just last week. And I think it's very important that we continue to scrutinize the assumptions that politicians and policymakers make about the power of the internet, because it will determine essentially how resources and how Western resources are being allocated to promote internet freedom. Just to give you an example, in Hillary Clinton's speech on internet freedom last week, for example, we haven't heard anything about the role that America's own companies, technology companies especially, play in facilitating some of this internet repression and internet control in authoritarian states. We know of many American firms which provide authoritarian governments with technology that allows them to monitor the internet traffic. We know many firms that provide authoritarian governments with technology that allows them to censor the internet and to build better firewalls. We know firms which give them tools to do data mining and basically learn more about dissidents and about online trends. All of these technologies are provided to these dictators very often by Western firms, many of them in the Silicon Valley. And I think it's very important for us to grasp the role that these companies are playing and to make sure that making them behave more responsibly is one of the core priorities in this fight for internet freedom. Mm. And so far it has not been acknowledged, and I think the only way to acknowledge it is for us to also understand that dictators are using the internet for their own purposes, and we have to prevent them from basically getting American technology and using it to oppress their own people. And it's very important, and I think so far it has been mostly unacknowledged by policymakers in Washington.
Well, let's talk some more about that, because certainly the United States government does impose controls on various kinds of technologies that have defense applications. Are you making the argument, or would you say that, in fact, that the United States government should put some restrictions on these kinds of technologies and to whom they can be sold?
Oh, definitely. Again, so far we see the opposite. We see that the U.S. government has, for example, sanctions in place against countries like Syria. So people in Syria cannot download software like Google Earth browser, or they cannot download tools like Skype, because American companies cannot legally export their technology to Syria because there are sanctions. So what we end up with is a situation where on the one hand, citizens of many of these authoritarian states do not have access to basic internet tools like browsers and Skype and instant messaging, while their governments are secretly buying technology from European firms or sometimes even American firms, which allows them to monitor and censor and suppress their own people. And I think that's something that needs to be acknowledged. And yes, we have to restructure the way our sanctions work and to probably make basic technologies like internet browsing and instant messaging exempt from the sanctions regime. But we also have to exert pressure on American firms and shame them for supplying technology that allows greater monitoring or censorship in authoritarian states. And so far, for example, the State Department has been very inconsistent on this subject. On the one hand, we have seen them being very critical of the Great Firewall of China. And the way it works is that it relies heavily on technology provided by an American company, Cisco, namely. But at the same time, just 2 months ago, the State Department gave Cisco an innovation award for the corporate excellence, and unrelated, of course, to what they did in China. But it's still a very incoherent message. And I think what I want to do is for people in Washington not just to be much more critical about the role that American companies play in all of this, but to be very explicit about the kind of assumptions they make about internet freedom. So far, it has been very eloquent speeches given by Hillary Clinton, but she has been very short on details. How exactly we should go about promoting internet freedom, what should be the priorities, be like who should receive our support, whether it will actually help some dissidents in the Middle East to receive funding from American government to oppose their the rulers, whether it's actually a normal situation where at the same time you have people in America training bloggers to oppose authoritarian rulers, while at the same time America supplies the same rulers with, you know, training and tear gas. And those are all big foreign policy questions. And so far, they have been barely acknowledged. And I think they need to be acknowledged and they need to be debated in Washington before we, go too far in naively promoting a concept of internet freedom without acknowledging all of the work that we need to do at home.
Hmm. Would you say in your particular case that there would have been a time when you would have been more positive about the liberating potential of these technologies, and at some point some series of factors came along that led you to think, well, perhaps in fact that it didn't have that? I mean, can you point to a particular time when your way of thinking about this changed?
Well, there was no specific episode, but it was just an accumulation of my own observations and frustrations. Mm-hmm. in this space. I come from Belarus, which is a country was probably the most dictatorial and harshest political environment in Europe. So I've always been fascinated by the question of promoting democratic values and the ways in which the West and America and Europe can help. So at some point I was extremely enthusiastic about the potential of the Internet, and that's what led me to study the subject. At the beginning, I was actually a practitioner. I joined an NGO which was using new media to basically help push for change in the former Soviet Union. So I spent several years traveling throughout Central Asia and the Caucasus and countries like Belarus and Moldova, trying to train bloggers and activists and journalists in using new media, in using blogs and social networking sites to campaign against their governments. And what I've discovered is that, first of all, the governments were becoming much, much smarter than the activists, some of them at least. The cases like Russia definitely seem to convince me that the governments were much smarter than we expected them to be in the online space. But I also noticed that there was very little understanding and awareness of the way in which the Internet helps authoritarian governments in Washington. We worked with a lot of donor organizations and government organizations in Washington with my NGO, and I just saw that many of the assumptions made about the Internet, they are very naive and simplistic. So I decided after, 3 years of doing that, I saw it was enough, and I just wanted to change to study the assumptions, but also to change them with this book. So I spent the following 3 years basically working on it. But there was no specific episode. Again, it's just been looking at reality and just seeing that things have not worked out the way many of us expected them, 5 or 10 years ago when we thought that social networking and tweets will be instrumental to toppling dictators everywhere, and it just hasn't happened.
And do you think that it's just the fact is that it just hasn't happened yet, or that actually there are issues here that would say that it's just not going to, it's not that it just hasn't happened yet, but it's just not going to happen?
Well, it may happen, but it requires more and more work on behalf of people who want it to happen. Right? So I do think that there is still a very impressive democratic potential to new media, and there is definitely a role that blogs and social networking sites can play in helping to democratize many of the authoritarian states. It's just that unless we in the West take on a more critical attitude and start scrutinizing the way in which these technologies are also being used for repression, I think it will become increasingly challenging and unlikely. So I do think we need to hope that the Internet will help, but we also need to be far more critical and look at our own responsibilities and just be far more nuanced and sophisticated. It's, you know, no one has canceled the laws of geopolitics just because now we have the internet. Doesn't mean that the countries will not respond to it according to their own interests and templates. So, of course, when you talk, when you have an American official from the State Department, you know, go on the record and say something like, Facebook is the most organic tool of democracy promotion the world has ever seen, which was actually the words that were uttered by a State Department official. Of course, the rest of the world will react to it very negatively. They will think that America just wants to use these tools to promote their own foreign policy objectives, and they'll probably want to replace those American tools with their own, thus making it much easier to censor them and control them. And this is exactly what the Chinese have done. And this is where you really have to stop and pause and think a little bit about the kind of statements that are made and the kind of assumptions that are made in Washington and see whether some of them may actually be harmful to the cause of internet freedom and whether we actually need far more nuance before we can actually turn the promise of the internet into something tangible.
We're a little bit past our midpoint in this hour of focus. Let me introduce again the guest, Evgeny Morozov. He's contributing editor to Foreign Policy and Boston Review. He's a fellow at the New American Foundation. He's also currently a visiting scholar at Stanford University. He previously was a Yahoo Fellow at the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Open Society Institute in New York, where he remains on the board of the Information Program. And his writings have appeared in a lot of places. I won't go down the whole list because there are just too many of them. He's also been interviewed widely, CNN, CBS, CBC, Al Jazeera International, BBC, and on and on. And if you're interested in reading some more of his ideas on this subject, you should look for his recent book. The title is The Net Delusion, the subtitle The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, and it is published by Public Affairs. Something else that you write about here in the book that I'd like to have you talk about, I think while it is true that a lot of policy people continue to talk about the liberating and democratizing potential of the internet here in the United States as being something that provides a way, and the associated tools provide a way for people to improve their lives and improve their communities and do a lot of good things. It is very clear that there is a growing ambivalence about the internet and an acknowledgement that it does have a dark side, that it is a way to circulate misinformation and disinformation, it is increasingly being used to sell things, and that, to put it plainly, there's a lot of junk on the internet. You say, in fact, that's not just a problem with Americans and what we're doing on the internet. If you look at developing countries or these places that we think it's going to be this great liberating tool, that people there they're indulging in a lot of the same kind of junk that we're indulging in. They're using it primarily for entertainment, and it's really not being used as a political organizing tool.
Sure. Well, I think there is some tendency to sort of glorify and glamorize the users of the internet in many of the authoritarian states. There is, I think, this tendency to view them as just digital equivalents of the old dissidents from, you know, the Cold War era. And we tend to think of internet users in Russia or China as just digital equivalents of Andrei Sakharov or Václav Havel. And definitely that's not the case. Many of them lead very normal lives online. They do not venture much into politics. They stick to entertainment or social networking or watching funny videos on YouTube. And this is something that needs to be acknowledged, in part because we need to be fairly clear about the kind of assumptions we make about the political potential of the internet. Right now in Washington, for example, there is a growing debate about how the United States government should spend its money on promoting internet freedom. And there are a lot of people who say that what we need to do is just to build tools which help to circumvent government censorship. And once we build those tools, people in Russia and China and Iran will immediately use them to go and read about how their governments are abusing human rights. And they will use those tools to mobilize and organize and pour into the streets and topple the government. And some of this, of course, is naive, but it's also naive because it just has a very, I think, simplistic view of what users in Russia, China, Iran actually do online. When they get unfiltered access, chances are they wouldn't jump to the website of Human Rights Watch. They'll jump to websites that offer them free pirated Hollywood movies or pornography. And this is something that we need to acknowledge if we really want to think about the kind of priorities we need to have and the kind of consequences we should expect from executing those priorities and acting on them. And the other point is that in the West, there is another tendency amongst policymakers to completely downplay the social ills that the Internet and problems that the Internet is also introducing to authoritarian countries. If you compare what Western politicians, and especially American politicians, say about the power, but also the potential downside of the Internet. When they talk about it in the context of their own countries, they are far more critical. They would talk about the flood of entertainment and infotainment and the fact that it's so hard to find credible information online. They'll talk about the video games and how they're destroying the education potential of the young people. All of those statements, by the way, come from speeches of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Both of them, when they talk to domestic audiences, they are far more critical about the kind of changes that the Internet is introducing to our society. However, when they go abroad and they address foreign audiences, they completely change the tone and the content of their speeches. It's all about information undermining authoritarian governments and citizens becoming more informed from the Internet and young people using it not to play video games but to topple the dictators. So I think there is this very weird tendency to completely miss on these sort of darker, more normal side to the Internet when we think about it in the foreign context. And I think this is very unfortunate. And again, this results in expectations that basically cannot be met because we just expect so much from the Internet and those contacts that no amount of funding or support for Internet freedom will actually make us happy.
Well, and certainly we can point to so many examples of places around the world where people are very concerned about the pervasive influence of Western popular culture, American popular culture particularly. And you can imagine that some people like that would see the Internet as just another way for that to leach into their country. And for that reason, they might not be really all that keen on it.
Sure. It's very important for us to have, I think, a somewhat more nuanced view of the political and social effects of the Internet and how it's affecting not just politics, but also culture, nationalism, religion. It is affecting all of them very strongly, and it does not eliminate them, as many of the theorists of the digital era predicted a few decades ago. If you turn to a book by Nicholas Negroponte, one of the most famous digital gurus, Being Digital, published, I think, in 1996, it actually predicts that in the era of the Internet, nationalism will go away, and it will be as rare as smallpox, I think. And this is definitely not happening. We're actually seeing the Internet strengthening many of the nationalist communities. We're seeing it being used to access various ethnic texts that have been banned in many countries, including Russia and China. So what we are seeing is a far more complex situation with many of the social, cultural, and political forces being amplified. And I think this is a very good model to actually think about the power of the Internet. It amplifies many of the existing social and political processes. We don't know whether it will amplify the pro-democratic and pro-Western and secular processes more than the others. It's possible that the other processes that may not be that conducive to democratization will be empowered and amplified far, far more. And it's very important to keep in mind when we think about the political changes that will be triggered by the Internet, because very often the kind of changes that will be triggered may not actually be in the interest of democracy and democratization, and we'll actually need to work hard to contain and limit them.
It seems to me that you make a fairly strong case here, or at least you support it well, and that there are some really important considerations here. There's certainly important people should be thinking about these things. But I know that some of your ideas and some of the things you have said have upset a lot of people very much. And maybe indeed those are the people who believe so very strongly in the positive power of the Internet. What sort of reaction have you gotten to some of your ideas and to this book?
I think it's actually quite a reasonable reaction from the policy world. So people who deal mostly with foreign policy issues, I think, are very grateful because, again, there has been, I think, more developments happening involving the Internet in the course of the last 2 years that anyone could actually digest. We've seen everything from, you know, the Stuxnet virus taking down the, or slowing down at least the Iranian nuclear system, to cyber wars in Georgia and Estonia, to, you know, research in motion, the manufacturer of BlackBerry being forced to share the encryption keys with governments, and of course all the Twitter revolutions happening around the globe. So there have been many developments, and I think there has been very little analysis done on that. So a lot of people so far who are tasked with foreign policy have been, I think, very enthusiastic and grateful for the book. There has been also a camp of people who have been somewhat less grateful and less happy, and those are people who mostly dealt with new media and the Internet, and who are many of the digital utopians that and cyber utopians that I describe in the book. And they have not been as happy, in part because they think that they hold far more sophisticated views than the ones I depict in the book. But I think the book is pretty well documented in terms of the claims that are often made. And often these claims about the power of the Internet to topple dictators are made in the popular press. They're made on, you know, CNN and NPR and others. And often you hear a lot of digital experts and Internet experts say, well, this is just popular media making all those statements. We are far more sophisticated. But I think it's very important to pay attention to what the popular media thinks about these issues as well, because eventually, most often, it's the press and the and television and the radio which end up having far more influence on policymakers. To me, it's very important to get the policy angle here, right? Because I think it's the question of Internet policy and Internet freedom policy especially, which will be more and more important for many foreign policymakers in Washington. And the way in which we learn about the Internet and the way in which we talk about the Internet, I think, is very important. So to me, it's very necessary, I think, to point out to some of the flaws and deficiencies in our current public debate about the Internet and the way in which it has been dominated mostly by people who have cyber utopian views and who do not want to acknowledge the darker side. And once we acknowledge that, I think our debate will get far better.
Maybe 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me again introduce the guest, Yevgeny Morozov. He's the author of the book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. It's published by Public Affairs, and it's recently out. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I think that often and justly, media is criticized for the way that it reports on new technologies, because when something new comes along, I think reporters often view it and talk about it with an almost childish kind of gee whiz enthusiasm fail to ask questions about, at least in the beginning, fail to ask questions about its implications. And certainly with the kinds of with the Internet and these kinds of communications technologies, I think that has been the case. Now, I don't know if that is just a reflection of the tendency that we have to embrace things, new things, when they come along just because they're new, or that has something to do with the fact that, well, these are communications technologies and we're in the communications business, and so maybe we think that's cool because of that.
It's been very fascinating for me, at least, to watch many of the reporters in the mainstream media, in radio and television and the newspapers, be very enthusiastic about the power of the Internet to liberate dictatorships, while also being extremely critical of the Internet for destroying their jobs. So there may be something, you know, Freudian here, where on the one hand they are extolling its powers to liberate people, and then they're also condemning it for basically bringing down the news industry. But there are many more factors that I think that need to be examined. For example, it's very important to consider how we actually learn about bloggers and how we learn about the struggles that they are fighting in places like the Middle East or places like Russia or China. And what happens is that we mostly learn about them from foreign correspondents. And it just happens that, you know, plenty of bloggers in China who are pro-government and who are nationalistic, who hate Western media and who think that it doesn't really understand China, they would never want to talk to BBC or CNN, and they would never want to talk to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. So what happens is that these correspondents end up interviewing and talking mostly to pro-Western and pro-democratic bloggers, and we end up with these very misleading narratives of, you know, bloggers being the new dissidents, or bloggers being all anti-government or pro-Western. And it's definitely not the case, simply because we have a very limited, you know, sample of bloggers that we talk to, or bloggers who actually want to talk to us in the West. And this, I think, what creates all of these very misleading images of bloggers as participating in the production of Samizdat, or bloggers, as I've said, as being the new dissidents. That's clearly not the case, because in countries like Iran or Russia, we actually, or China, we actually see a lot of bloggers who are far more conservative and anti-democratic and anti-Western than their governments. And that's very important to acknowledge, otherwise we'll again fall into the trap of viewing all users, internet users in those countries as digital equivalents of, you know, dissidents, and they aren't. But broadly speaking, you know, historically, of course, there is a tendency for the media to overstate, I think, the importance of all of these tools. It didn't just happen with the internet. It also happened with the telegraph and the radio and even the airplane. All of those tools have been heralded as some kind of you know, tools that will result in more democracy and more peace and less war. And that didn't happen. But often, the reason why they got so much positive coverage was because the inventors, they're very skilled in manipulating the public discourse and then manipulating how we think about these technologies. And this is part of what's happening now with the founders of Google proclaiming that they don't do evil, or the founders of Twitter claiming that, you know, their tool will just, you know, enhance humanity. And we just need to be very critical of the claims that these founders make.
And, you know, it seems that pretty clear that there's no going back on these things. At the same time, for people who do want to use them, who are political activists, who are challenging governments, who do want to use them, are they thinking differently about them? Are they, for example, fully aware of the way their governments are also using those tools and trying to use them against them?
I think some of them are. We definitely see a lot of dissidents who have been trained and who have knowledge about the vulnerabilities involved in using tools like Facebook or Twitter for communication. But you see, the promise of social media has always been that it will allow those dissidents to link up to the broader population, to people who may not yet be dissidents, who may not yet be campaigning, who may just be on YouTube watching funny cat videos, or who may just be on Facebook checking photos from their friends. And they'll be able to reach out to them and direct them to anti-government groups or videos, and thus gain more followers. And the problem is that this broader audience, they are not as well aware about the dangers and risks and the tools as the professional dissidents. So we do need to pay closer attention to some of the default settings that services like Facebook and Twitter offer. We can probably enhance the anonymity of many of its users very easily just by pushing Facebook and Twitter and Google and others to adopt more responsible and privacy-friendly, default settings as to how they share their data, how they disclose it to advertisers and so forth. And so far, this is not happening for very good reasons, because it will not help the business interests of these companies. But I think it needs to happen, and we need to exert more pressure on these companies. Even Facebook, which has been credited with facilitating this protest in Tunisia and Egypt, what they refuse to do still is to allow dissidents and protesters to use their site using their pseudonyms and false names. You cannot be a Chinese dissident using a pseudonym on Facebook, or Facebook will delete your account, as it has in the past. And this is a big problem, and this is where I think we need to exert more pressure on these companies, either by pushing our own politicians to be more responsible, or by just, you know, campaigning and exerting some kind of civil society pressure on them.
Well, we just have about a minute and a half left. As a final question, I realize this is complicated, but I think when looking at problematic technologies, people and their implications, people may have two extreme sorts of ways to approach them. Either to deal with their problems, we just say we'll abandon those technologies, or we say, well, if technology causes problems, technology can also solve them. So is there a technological fix to the kinds of problems that we have talked about connected with this technology?
There are some. It's possible to fix the problem of internet filtering, for example. It's possible to build tools that will allow people to bypass internet censorship. However, it's also possible that the governments will just switch to more social rather than technological means of censorship and intimidation. Instead of censoring blogs, they will just stop harassing and beating up bloggers. They'll start launching cyber attacks on their websites. So it's a very fine and delicate balance. I mean, it's just because it's possible to solve some of those problems by technology doesn't mean that the situation will get better. So we need to be very careful here and to make sure we don't do more harm by solving the technological problems but creating more social problems that we don't actually know how to solve, like intimidation or new laws that will be passed to require, for example, everyone who uses internet and an internet cafe to submit a copy of their passport, which is happening in many authoritarian states right now. So we have to be very careful, but I think some of these problems are solvable. We just need to not to rush and take a more measured approach to solving them.
Our guest in this hour of focus, Evgeny Morozov, contributing editor to Foreign Policy and Boston Review. He's a fellow at the New American Foundation, currently a visiting scholar at Stanford University, and he is author of the book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, and it is published by Public Affairs. Mr. Morozov, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
The conversation you've just heard with Evgeny Morozov comes from the Focus Archive. It was first presented in February of 2011, and many past shows are there, available for you, ready whenever you're ready to listen. You can go to our website, that's WILL.illinois.edu. And there you will find the schedule for next week. And let me tell you about Monday on the program. The guest in the 10 o'clock hour is Susan Cain. She is both an attorney and a writer who's produced a book that makes the argument in favor of people who are introverted. The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. That is the subtitle. The title of the book is Quiet. That's hour number one. Then the second hour, we'll have a conversation with another candidate. We're having a number of candidates here who are running for positions in the State House and the Congress. And this time around, that's Monday, the guest will be Robert Roman. He is the Director of Resources for the Division of Management Information at the U of I, and he is a Republican candidate in the new 102nd House District running against Adam Brown. He was on our program last month, and that is on the archive. And then you'll have the opportunity to hear Bob Roman on Monday. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. And you can check out the schedule by going to WILL.illinois.edu.
Support for Stock and Commodity Reports on Illinois Public Media comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, now hosting risk management seminars. A complete list of seminars is at sfarmmarketing.com. We would like to thank these businesses for helping to make our 22nd annual All-Day Ag Outlook meeting in Covington a great success. Risk Management Commodities, Farm Credit Services, and Steel Star Metal Roofing and Siding. We look forward to seeing you all again next year.
Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. In Kansas City, May wheat, 684, up 5¾. July, 692½, up 6. March wheat in Chicago, 639, up 8½. The May contract, 641¾, up 7. March corn, 656¼, up 11¼. May, 645¾, up 10¼. July, 645¼, up 8¼. September, 594, up 4. March soybeans, 1326¼, down 6¼. May, 1332¼, down 6¼. July, 1339¼, down 5½. August, 1330¼, down 6¼. March meal, 357.20, down 6. March oil, 54 even,